Law and Grace, Chapter 9, Part A. Holiness to the Lord, Israel's life objectively depicted, symbols in combination. There were, as we have seen, six altar offerings in all, each differing in complexion and in meaning from the others. Why were there so many? Simply because no fewer would have sufficed. As no one symbol on its own could possibly have been versatile enough, it needed that number to teach all the lessons which the ritual of sacrifice was intended to convey. A burnt offering, for example, though typifying to perfection the offerer's desire to dedicate himself entirely to God, could not serve to typify as well his consciousness of enjoying fellowship with God, since it left him with nothing of which to make a sacrificial meal. Conversely, peace offering, while it spoke eloquently of fellowship, could not also, in the nature of things, serve as a symbol of total self-consecration. In turn, neither burnt offering nor peace offering, by virtue of their character, qualified to represent adequately the offerer's recognition that his sin, so long as it remained unexpiated, alienated him from God and deprived him of the right to offer God his service. Sin offering alone was adequate for that purpose. In brief, none of the altar offerings was sufficient in itself, so the law overcame this limitation by delegating to each of them a special primary function. This enabled each one to help make good the deficiencies of the others, with the result that all, in the aggregate, taught the etiquette of sacrificial worship in its completeness. As we have seen, they all, in combination, made plain to every Israelite that his first and fundamental need was forgiveness for his sin, sin offering, that his contrition was of no avail unless it expressed itself in amendment of life, trespass offering, that God's willingness to pardon him brought him under the obligation to dedicate himself, burnt offering, and his labours, meal and drink offering, unconditionally to God's service, and that he, enjoying the privilege of fellowship with God, had to realize its implications in terms of holy living, peace offering. We see, therefore, that though no given symbol was able to present all the aspects of worship simultaneously, and with the same degree of potency, yet all the symbols together ensured that no truth was either left unmentioned or insufficiently stressed. And for this reason also, there was a certain comprehensiveness and self-sufficiency about the sacrificial ritual, which has made it both possible and convenient for us to study it so far in isolation from the rest of the law. In actual fact, however, in the same way as the various altar offerings were but subdivisions of a complete sacrificial scheme, that scheme itself was likewise but a subdivision of the whole symbolical system of the law. We need, therefore, now to review them all afresh, this time against the background of the whole remaining symbolism of the law, since they can only assume their true beauty and full significance for us by being studied in relation to that system in its entirety. As our inquiries into the uncleanness laws have already made quite plain, for simplicity and efficiency, our method of inquiry will have to be selective, so we shall limit ourselves to three special and outstanding occasions when the law made use of several sacrifices at one time, and then proceeded to deal with the peculiar ritual of the jealousy offering, which, while bearing a certain resemblance to both sin and meal offering, is yet so distinctive that it cannot be fitted into any of the categories of offering which we have so far examined. This procedure will have a double usefulness. It will entail much incidental revision of matters already studied in other connections, thus serving to consolidate our knowledge. It will also correlate for us several seemingly disconnected facts which we have learned as a result of our earlier researches. The effect will be to deepen our conviction of the essential unity and consistency of the law, and to bring its great theme studies into a clearer focus before us. God declared at Sinai, "Now therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." Hearing this, the assembled Israelites chose to accept both the distinction offered them and the condition which went with it. All the people answered together and said, "All that the Lord hath spoken, we will do." To be a dynasty of priests, to be a holy nation, that was why God had called forth a mass of slaves from Egypt. Here, summarily stated, was Israel's status, and with it Israel's duty. Here were its privileges and its responsibilities defined in one simple formula. It's precisely because of this that Aaron was so perfectly qualified to act as a type of the nation as a whole. He was, in fact, as we have seen, the priestly people in miniature. His ministrations at the altar, in the holy place, and even also in the most holy place, were essentially representative in character and bore witness to Israel's ideal destiny. But they bore witness to much besides, for in this matter, as in so many others, the law contrived simultaneously to present Israel with an ideal and also to bring it face to face with the grim reality of its sinfulness. Not all and sundry among the priestly people, no, none but Aaron and his sons were authorized to minister at the altar. While this certainly implied that none but the priestly people had the right to draw nigh to God, and laid stress upon its status and its privileges, it was also a stern reminder that the nation was in reality unfit to assume those privileges, being itself in need of priestly mediators to act on its behalf. So lamentably did it fall short of its true glory. In the light of this fact, the ritual of the consecration of the priests was clearly intended to be of momentous significance to the entire nation. As we would expect, it was conducted in full view of the assembled people. Its lessons were for them, every one of them, therefore, and were intended expressly for their spiritual guidance. They were to see in the priests objective representations of themselves, and to find in the symbolism of the consecration service at once a spur to effort and a check to pride. The service was to be for them an enacted parable, bidding them both seek after holiness and eschew all forms of evil, in pursuit of their true duty as God's priestly people. And not for them only, for as each high priest succeeded to the office of his predecessor, so the ceremonial had to be transacted anew. The holy garments shall be his sons, after him to be anointed therein and to be consecrated in them. As the original service had to last 7 days in all, so also had that conducted on behalf of each of Aaron's successors. And that son that is priest in his stead shall put them on 7 days when he cometh into the tabernacle of the congregation to minister in the holy place. Thus the law arranged that each successive generation in Israel should be reminded in an official and conspicuous fashion of its duty as God's priestly people. The lesson was for all time, and not for the wilderness generation only. We need to bear this in mind while examining the special features of the original consecration service. The officiating minister on this first occasion was Moses. He alone, as mediator of the covenant, was in the position to induct Aaron and his sons into office. The significance of this fact as a token of the inadequacy of the law we must leave for later study. It is the practical details and their moral significance only that must engross us now. Moses received clear instructions as to the duties which were to occupy him for the duration of the consecration service. Both the sanctuary and the priesthood were to be sanctified on the same occasion and in conjunction with each other. So close was the relationship of the one to the other. Upon the erection of the sanctuary, the priesthood needed forthwith to be installed in office in order that the purpose of both might be realized. I will sanctify the tabernacle of the congregation and the altar. I will sanctify also both Aaron and his sons to minister unto me in the priest's office, and I will dwell among the children of Israel and will be their God. And they shall know that I am the Lord their God that brought them forth out of the land of Egypt, that I may dwell among them. I am the Lord their God. Sanctuary and priesthood were thus parallel types, as we've already seen. The sacrificial element in the consecration ritual was therefore clearly designed to teach the nation on what conditions God in his holiness could condescend to dwell among them, and they themselves might be prepared to receive him into their midst. We must accordingly pay close attention both to the order and to the character of events on these seven momentous days. God had said to Moses, this is the thing that thou shalt do unto them to minister unto me in the priest's office. Take one young bullock and two rams without blemish and unleavened bread and cakes unleavened, tempered with oil, and wafers unleavened, anointed with oil. Of wheaten flour shalt thou make them, and thou shalt put them into one basket, and bring them in the basket with the bullock and the two rams. Against the arrival of the priests-to-be and of the assembled nation, Moses had also to have ready the garments and the anointing oil. The details of the consecration service can now be passed in rapid chronological review. 1. Moses washed Aaron and his sons with water. 2. Moses enrobed Aaron in his special high priestly dress. 3. Moses anointed the tabernacle and its interior to sanctify them. He then sprinkled the altar 7 times and anointed both it and the laver to sanctify them and all pertaining to them. 4. Moses poured the anointing oil on Aaron's head and anointed him to sanctify him. 5. Moses enrobed and anointed Aaron's sons. 6. Aaron and his sons put their hands upon the head of the bullock. Moses then slew this as a sin offering, smeared some of the blood on the horns of the altar, poured the remainder at its base, burnt the animal's fat upon the altar, and then had the whole of its carcass burnt outside the camp. 7. Aaron and his sons next put their hands upon the head of one of the rams. Moses then slew the ram, splashed its blood against the sides of the altar, and then burnt it upon the altar as a burnt offering. 8. Aaron and his sons placed their hands on the head of the second ram, the ram of consecration, as it is called. And Moses then killed it, placed some of its blood on the lobe of Aaron's right ear, the thumb of his right hand, on the great toe of his right foot. Then, having done the same thing in the case of each of Aaron's sons, splashed the remainder of the blood against the sides of the altar. 9. Moses took the animal's fat, including in this case the tail, of course, and its right leg, and placing upon them one unleavened cake, one cake of oiled bread, and one wafer, rested the whole on the hands of Aaron and his sons, who waved them to and fro in company with Moses before handing them back to him to be burnt upon the altar. 10. Moses waved the animal's breast and then retained it as his perquisite for use as food. 11. Moses mingled blood from the altar with the remaining oil and sprinkled Aaron and his sons with the mixture as they stood before him in their robes of office. 12. Aaron and his sons then stewed the remaining flesh and ate it with the rest of the contents of the basket, later disposing of all the residue of the flesh and bread by burning it. 13. During the whole period of their 7 days' consecration, Aaron and his sons were strictly forbidden to leave the court. None but he and his sons were to eat of the flesh of the ram of consecration. Now that we are familiar with the bare facts, we can proceed to abstract from them the lessons which they were meant to convey to the assembled people who witnessed the transactions in the court. Everything we note, some 12 times in all, was done as the Lord commanded Moses. That is, nothing was left to chance. Before the robes of office could even be assumed, the bodies of the priests had first to be washed. Thus sinlessness was decreed at the outset to be the prerequisite of real priesthood. Once robed in his official garb, Aaron was in need forthwith of anointing that he might be sanctified to discharge his duties before God. This anointing was strictly of the head only, but the head, being the directing agent of all the body's actions, clearly stood for the whole man, so that the anointing of it effectively and conspicuously intimated that he needed a rich endowment of God's Spirit to qualify him to execute the priesthood in the way required by him. A fact which the profusion of the anointing in his case served to emphasize, since it became proverbial that the precious ointment upon the head ran down upon the beard, even Aaron's beard, and ran down to the skirts of his garments. The consecration of the priests was such that it entailed total separation to God. Hence, the strict injunction, "Ye shall not go out of the door of the tabernacle of the congregation in 7 days." This time cycle of 7 days, the symbolic period, as in the case of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, taught the people that they were ever to remain spiritually in the very vicinity of God, if they were to be what they were meant to be, his priestly people in covenant relationship to him. The notion of that relationship was, in fact, given special prominence. Moses sprinkled the altar, which symbolized God, 7 times before anointing it, as a token that it was solely the condescension of God as the covenant God which gave his people their right of access to him. This fact was declared with special force in the sacrificial ritual which followed. though sinlessness was the prerequisite of real priesthood, Aaron could not attain to it, nor by extension, therefore, could the nation either. So the first of the animal sacrifices was appropriately a sin offering, a salutary reminder to the people that their first need was forgiveness. But beside being the first offering, the bullock was also the largest, so that forgiveness was declared to be not only the people's first, but also their greatest need. Nothing could be calculated to check their pride more effectively than this. Next came burnt offering and peace offering in that order. The size and value of the animals, both rams, was this time the same, so that the notions of self-consecration and fellowship were given exactly equal prominence. The offerings bore in upon the people that their duty was to respond to God's mercy in forgiving their sin by devoting themselves completely to Him, burnt offering, and by sinlessness honoring their privilege of fellowship with Him, peace offering. The unblemished nature of all three sacrifices made Israel's duty plain. So did the basket of loaves, cakes, and wafers, some of which were used to feed God, and some to feed the priests themselves. They had to be of the best flour, wheaten flour, and free from leaven. That is, God demanded of His priests, and so of His priestly people as a whole, the best that they could give. No less, in fact, than total sinlessness, for this, and nothing but this, was the fitting feature of that fellowship with Him which was symbolized by the burning of some of the loaves and the eating of the others. None but the truly holy were entitled to eat with God. Aaron and his sons shall eat those things wherewith the atonement was made, to consecrate and to sanctify them, but a stranger shall not eat thereof, because they are holy. The lesson here was twofold. Firstly, none but members of the priestly family were entitled to eat, because the offerings were holy, a regulation emphasizing that membership of that family was a very exclusive privilege. Secondly, the holiness of the offerings was assumed to have its counterpart in the eaters themselves, which meant that those among the priests who ate and yet were not morally holy were in reality strangers to God. The moral for the nation at large was plain. The eating of the sacrificial flesh by the priests was a token of the fellowship with God enjoyed by the priestly people. The lesson for them, as for Aaron and his sons, was that not even a suggestion of moral corruption was compatible with priestly status. If aught of the flesh of the consecrations or of the bread remain unto the morning, then thou shalt burn the remainder with fire. It shall not be eaten, because it is holy. Holiness and corruption are mutually exclusive. And in the case of the covenant people, the one must oust the other. That was the moral which this regulation taught. In the sin offering and the peace offering alike, God's claim was for the fat, the best and richest portion of man's spiritual life. In the burning of the right leg upon the altar, not only were the rights of the priests settled for the future, but the claim was also made by God for the best part of man's physical life. The service of the priests was to be a professional one. The whole of their working day and working life was to be devoted to it. That is, God demanded of His people their constant and unreserved loyalty and service. The ministry of the altar consequently entailed the consecration of ear, hand, and foot. The lobe, thumb, and great toe standing on the principle of representation for much more than themselves. That is, God's priestly people were meant to realize that God's law was constantly to be heeded, the ear, acted upon, the hand, made the rule for daily walk, the foot. Not till all these lessons had been ritually conveyed and the priests had been sprinkled with mingled blood and oil, the one speaking of pardon, the other of consecration, as they stood in their official robes, were they permitted to eat the flesh of the ram of consecration and the loaves in token of their priestly fellowship with God most holy. And for 7 days in succession, these same great lessons were reiterated at every turn. At the end of that momentous week, the reflective onlookers could not have failed to appreciate the character of their fundamental duty. The words would almost frame themselves in their minds. Ye shall be holy unto me, for I, the Lord, am holy, and have severed you from other people that ye should be mine. Most ominous would be Moses' words to Aaron, therefore shall ye abide at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation day and night 7 days, and keep the charge of the Lord that ye die not, for so I am commanded. They were a timely reminder that God's claims for holiness cannot be trifled with by those who profess to be his people. On the eighth day, Aaron and his sons began their priestly service proper. Once more, events were transacted publicly. Moses called Aaron and his sons and the elders of Israel. The former presented a young calf for a sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering, the latter a goat for a sin offering, a calf and a lamb for a burnt offering, and a bullock and a ram for peace offerings, together with a meal offering mingled with oil. All the animals were moreover to be without blemish. And then all the congregation drew near and stood before the Lord. In the audience of the people, Moses said, this is the thing which the Lord commanded that ye should do, and the glory of the Lord shall appear unto you. And Moses said unto Aaron, go unto the altar and offer thy sin offering, and make atonement for thyself and for the people, and offer the offering of the people, and make an atonement for them, as the Lord commanded. Now, this declaration by Moses is charged with significance. The goal of Israel's priestly calling was made plain. The glory of the Lord shall appear unto you. So also was Aaron's representative character made plain. Offer thy sin offering and make atonement for thyself and for the people. Nothing could be more plainly indicate that he was henceforward to be regarded as the microcosm of the entire priestly nation. So that was what was true of him was by implication also true of them. Everyone. Once again, sin offering came first for Aaron as well as for those for whom he now stood, thus declaring the covering of sin to be their primary need. Then next, in the case both of Aaron and the people, came burnt offering. It was with this that the meal offering mingled with oil was offered. For as we now know, no meal offering ever accompanied sin offering. Thus Israel were reminded that God demanded both total self-surrender and consecrated service to him. Without these, no real fellowship with him was possible. and that such fellowship was intended to be the aim and end of Israel's priestly status was shown by the command that a bullock and a ram should be offered as peace offerings, so as to provide the basis for a joyous sacrificial meal to end the sacrificial round. Aaron, having thus entered upon the discharge of his priestly functions, lifted up his hand toward the people and blessed them, doubtless saying to the assembled multitude, "The Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make his face to shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee. The Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace." Nothing now remained but for Moses to induct Aaron into the tabernacle itself, which he did. And coming out together, they then both blessed the people afresh. Their blessing took immediate effect, and the glory of the Lord appeared unto all the people, and there came a fire out from before the Lord and consumed upon the altar the burnt offering and the fat, which when all the people saw, they shouted and fell on their faces. God had before declared in reference to the altar, "There I will meet with the children of Israel, and the tabernacle shall be sanctified by my glory, and I will dwell among the children of Israel, and will be their God." The events of the eighth day were proof of God's fidelity, and a gauge also that his purpose with Israel will assuredly one day be realized, despite all their failures, both in the wilderness and later in the land of their possession. Then a cloud covered the tent of the congregation, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle, so that temporarily Moses could not enter. Thus, unmistakably, was God's purpose with Israel declared, so that the command to exclude from the camp the unclean and defiled became inevitable. Their presence there, as we have seen, being incompatible with God's occupation of the tabernacle.